In the previous episode, one talked about Phoenicia and Carthage, their history, and their struggles against Greece and Rome. Now it's time to stop for a moment to talk about two aspects of their culture in order to see them in more detail without going into too much detail. One of them is their religion, their mythology, about which very little is known, since the few sources that have survived are the Bible, several texts by Ross Samra, and the supposed writer Sanchoniathon. The other topic is their alphabet, an alphabet that gave rise to our Latin alphabet, Greek, Arabic, and Hebrew, among others.
Do you know the alphabet? You know it, don't you?
A, B, C, D, M. At the forefront of the Canaanite worldview was the God, the Supreme God, father of all the gods and creatures of the world, who had little control over what happened on earth. But unlike the Hebrew God, this one had a wife who was known as Ashtoreth, Ashtaroth, Astarte or Asherah or Tanit in Carthage, represented as a tree or as a steel next to the altars. To complete the trinity was the sun god Baal, god of storms, who in certain places and times was represented as a calf and later took on human form. In addition, Baal had many names associated with the place where he was being worshipped: Balad, Balaman, Balermon, Baalzor, and the best known Baalzezel, Lord Prince, also worshipped by the Philistines and better known as Baalzebuth or Beelzebub. This last name would be the nickname that the Hebrews gave him as a joke, which means Lord of the Flies, because their temples were full of these insects for not cleaning the rotten meat from the sacrifices that were made there. It may also have originated the name Belial, since both are associated with Satan. Oh, how scary. The cult of Baal was related to fertility and the rainy season of that region. In summer, there was hardly any rain, and the Canaanites interpreted this as death and drought personified in the god Em, defeating Baal in an eternal cyclical struggle and taking him to the underworld. Baal was rescued by his sister and wife, Nat, goddess of love and war, who gave milk to Mo and scattered his remains over the fields. Baal's return to his throne restarted the rainy season, and all the Canaanites celebrated it with sexual orgies. This explanation of seasonal cycles is practically identical to the rescue of Ishtar and Nana from Tumut-Dumut in Sumerian mythology, or to the struggle between Re and Apophis in ancient Egypt, not to mention the resurrected Christian god the sun. Other enemies of Baal were Yam, god of the sea, and Ataru of the desert, whom he had to defeat first. Furthermore, Baal was also known in Tyre by the name of Melkart, and his cult would reach as far as distant Carthage and the Iberian Peninsula, giving rise to various myths related to navigation. For example, the mythical columns of Melkart or Hercules that marked the end of the world, and the hunter Smaun, patron saint of Sidon, also stands out. Note that the goddess Astarte did not stop harassing him, so he decided to castrate himself with an axe.
People have a bit of a crazy head.
Then the goddess healed him through heat and turned him into a god of healing. Furthermore, it seems that this god with a tendency to self-immolation threw himself onto a pyre of fire and was also resurrected. Every year the Phoenicians commemorated this resurrection in a festival called Jurgis, the Awakening, in which there was a game in his honor in which the winner received a purple cloth. It is believed that these two gods inspired the Greco-Roman gods, Heracles, Hercules, and Asclepius, Aesculapius, respectively. Another god was Dagon, who is supposed to have been the god of cereals, since Dagon meant wheat or seed. He has often been associated with him himself. Due to the similarity, he has also been related to Dagon, the main Philistine god who was half man and half fish, identified with the Sumero-Babylonian Ones. This god inspired H.P. Lovecraft for his story The Shadow Over Innsmouth. Apart from these, there were many more Baals, but with more secondary importance. These gods influenced all the Emitic peoples of the Levant, such as the Amorites, Moabites, and, of course, the Phoenicians. And it may have also partly affected the Hebrew religion. The latter would call any pagan god Baal without distinction. In fact, the name Israel means the one who fights against him, and this is not the only name associated with these gods. And we come to the controversial Moloch, who appears quite a few times in the Bible. According to this book, Moloch was an anthropomorphic god with a ram's head to whom children had to be burned in order to worship him. There is quite a bit of confusion about this bloodthirsty god, as some identify him with another god called Molech, with Milcom, with Melkart, or it also seems that he might not be a god at all but the name of the sacrifice. After the ritual, animal entrails were usually read to know the future. Divination, magic, and astrology were the order of the day. For you, Luis, I pass you this egg in the name of God, the Father, and the Holy Trinity. Around the year 1370 BC, the most widely spoken language in Mesopotamia was Akkadian. However, a king of Ugarit named Nicmadu-Sagun decided to build a large library in the city and treasure the most important texts related to his religion and history. Very little was saved from that library, but in it they found the first evidence of the language, a local language that first used a graphic alphabetic system with 31 letters represented by C uniform signs. It seems that this would evolve into the Phoenician alphabet that abandoned cuneiform, because it was fine to write on clay tablets, but it was rare to write on papyrus, which was the fashion. They needed something simpler so that anyone could learn it and be able to do business. There is also evidence in the Sinai Peninsula of an alphabet adapted from Egyptian called the Proto-Sinaitic alphabet, which could also be linked to the origin of Phoenician. The Phoenician alphabet was written from right to left. It had 22 characters, each representing a sound, and only one of them was a vowel. It seems that this vowel did not appear until the Punic period. These types of alphabets without vowels are called abjads, and that explains why Hebrew and Arabic do not have vowels in the strict sense, but rather dots and syllables are added to form them. The Greeks, who also adapted their language to the alphabet, decided to stop using vowels and create vowel signs, which is where the Etruscan alphabet and later our Latin alphabet came from. To create these first letters, they associated them with the phoneme of a common word that began with a certain sound. A, considered the most natural sound of humans and that even mute people can pronounce, it is likely that its graphic representation is based on the Phoenician leph, which meant ox. Its symbol may have started out as an ox's head that later turned over time. For a long time, the theory circulated that its origin was in the ancient tripods used to draw water while people were panting. It would later give rise to the Greek alpha, from which the mythical biblical expression of alpha and omega, the beginning and the end, would come. The sound B exists in practically all existing cultures, and I'm sure you think it is related to sheep. Bet meant house and was drawn as a kind of tent or basic building. It would give rise to the Greek beta by rounding its shape. The Romans barely used it. They were more of the UV phoneme. The letters C and G are closely linked. It seems that this gimel sign was a boomerang or boomerang weapon and then derived into dromedary camel representing its hump. It would give rise to the Greek range with which the G sound was represented and to the cape for K. The Latins combined these two sounds into C. It is not known exactly why. The thing is that they had three K phonemes, but no specific letter for the G sound. And sometime later, a guy named Carvilius, to avoid unnecessary confusion, invented the current letter G just for that sound. The phonetic confusion of these two letters persists in Spanish. C can be K, Z, or, without counting double CS and G, the same G or J, with or without U. Also, C is S in Russian and Andalusian. Damn polyphony. Furthermore, the Visigoths would later introduce the CCD into Europe, which Castilian ended up removing during the Middle Ages. Our beloved D is an Egyptian hieroglyph meaning door, first rectangular and then triangular, as that was how the pieces of leather on the doors of ancient tents looked. The letter was called datet. Another theory suggests that it comes from the ideogram of a fish in the Proto-Sinaitic alphabet. The triangular shape would come to form the Greek delta. A praying figure could be the origin of RE, and Lil was admired in Egyptian hieroglyphics. Others say that the Semitic G represented a window. In any case, that's where the Greek YLon came from, turned by the fashion of boustrophedon, which would become our vowel sound E and which became widespread in Latin. Of course, during the Middle Ages in England there was a great vowel shift as a result of migrations and confluences of many dialects, and that ended up causing the English to pronounce some vowels as if they had changed their order. In Proto-Sinaitic times, wow was a sound represented by a type of club whose rounded shape would gradually open out until it gave rise to the Y, and F evolved from there. The Greeks created the diema, which sounded like a W, and the Romans gave it its current sound, but it was eclipsed for a long time, until almost the 19th century, by the digraph PH, which came from the Greek phi, which was left without representation. The V also comes from this sign wow, although it did not appear until Latin. The U, for its part, appeared around the 24th century in the Latin alphabet. It was a variant of the V and sometimes became a vowel. Much later, V for a consonant and U for a vowel were differentiated, and we arrive at the W, which has Germanic, Visigothic origin. Or perhaps it was the Latins themselves who decided to create a new letter for the W sound that they did not know, but that these northern peoples did use. It came to Castilian because many scholars of the 15th century found it impossible to translate the names of kings and places from the stories of the Germanic people. Even now, the translations of the foreign W, our pronunciation, are a bit confusing. It can be a V or a B like Wagner or BTER, and also a Ginton. The origin of this letter is in the Egyptian ged, which meant fence or wall. In Proto-Sinaitic, on the other hand, it looked more like a braid. In Greece it gave rise to the Greek letter eta. However, in Etruria and in the Western Greek colonies it kept that soft J, and from there it passed into Latin, and from there to the present day when it ended up losing its sound. The big question is, why the hell do we have an H in Castilian if it doesn't have any sound? Well, more than anything because of tradition, since centuries ago it did have one and we still have remnants of it, like in Sahara. The Romans also faced this problem. Removing it or not removing it was strange. It was like an aspiration. Was it really a sound, a noise? People stopped using it, but in Rome, as everywhere else, there were scholars who liked to show off and put it everywhere. That's what made it survive to this day. Yes. Just like C and G, I and J are first cousins. It all starts, of course, in Phoenician, with the letter Y, which is believed to represent a hand. This letter evolved into the Greek letter Y, a stick without a dot or a vowel. The Y sound became the letter Y, which the Romans took a long time to include and they called it Y. The dot on the I appeared when italics began to be used in the Romance languages that were confused with the EU and they said, well, let's just give it a dot to differentiate it. There was never a J sound in the ancient alphabets, so it's no wonder that J was the last letter to be added to the Latin alphabet. It was in the 15th century by the French humanist Pierre de Lerame and was later popularized by Dutch printing presses. Its name, as is obvious, comes from the Yoda. If you hear the expression no vir ni J, you already know why it is. Then they ended up messing it up with the G and the X, like Mexico, although the latter has already been fixed, but not the GS. The X represents the unknown and this is a thing of the Arab mathematicians who used it as such, but its origin is also quite unknown. It is believed that it would come from the symbol of the Egyptian pillar 10 and that in Greece it ended up deriving into two symbols, the letters X and G. And as I have already said, the Latin started the mess that led to the classical pronunciation of X as J in some cases. The truth is that here, except in the Basque lock, it has been the pariah letter par excellence in our alphabet. It was a repeated letter that was useless. It comes from the Semitic CAF, which was the palm of a hand. This in turn could have come from the Egyptian hieroglyph for a hand, although its sound was different. The Greeks took that K sound for their letter K and in Latin they barely used it, since they preferred the letter C, but again it was the vintage posturing that made the K somewhat famous in the Middle Ages. But the K is cool, especially for translations, into Japanese or German. In Greek, 1000 was said kilioi. Kilos was a word that meant donkey and that's where our kilometer comes from. We measure distance in donkeys. Our L comes from the word lames of the Phoenician alphabet, which means silent or stick. The sign was taken from Proto-Sino and was adapted to Greek with the letter lambda, which ended up being a triangle. Then Latin recovered the form we know. Mo was the Egyptian word for water, while Uzes was to save. That's where the name of Moses, the one saved from the waters, comes from. Well, the origin of this letter is in the land of the pyramids. The hieroglyph for water is quite obvious. Then the Phoenician alphabet adopted it for its undulating mem, its word for umbrella. And not only did Moses owe his name to water, but also Madrid. Yes, apparently the Spanish capital was built on underground water channels that supplied the city, which is why the Arabs called it a land rich in water, that is, mate. The Greeks took the Phoenician H for their Greek MI. While some consider the precursor sign of the N to be a shortened variant of the M, it could also have been represented as a snake or an eel. Nun was snake in Phoenician and the letter was called Ni in Greek. It has barely changed since then. While in Arab and Indian traditions the circle was a symbol of nothingness representing the number zero, this was not the case in the Greco-Latin world, at least until we adapted to Arabic numerals. But the history of the letter O began when the Phoenicians took the Egyptian hieroglyph representing an I and simplified it. There was the name of that letter, mind you, with a sound that ended up falling out of use and becoming a vowel. This sound gave rise to the two O's of the Greek alphabet, omega, the long O, and omicron, the short O. The Romans eliminated this distinction. They kept the round O, but they still didn't have the number zero. As a curiosity, in Irish tradition, O ended up being a letter that indicated the son of a father in surnames, such as Connor or Brian, etc.
Incredible, but true.
A monkey, that was what an ancient hieroglyph represented, which the Phoenicians ended up adapting as the letter Q, a chupacus. The Greeks would use it to make the letter quopa, while the Romans wanted to eliminate it, since they already had the letter C, but they didn't have the balls. And speaking of heads, R also derives from a head, but this time a human one. Res was head in Phoenician, and they reduced the Egyptian head to a kind of inverted P. The Greeks, with the aforementioned boustrophedon script, turned it horizontally and the letter R appeared. The Romans saw this letter as problematic, since it represented both the P and R sounds. It would not be until the 3rd century that they decided to create a new letter, adding a dash to that P. On the other hand, the P sound among the ancients was a mouth P. This sign would reach Greece and would become the P that we know from the mates. During the 19th century, it was considered to make a kind of nier for the Castilian double R, but it did not end up taking hold. But something that did remain from the Greeks is the letter psi, which would give rise to words such as psyche or psychology. The origin of the S is somewhat disconcerting. It seems that its shape comes from the ancient Egyptian hieroglyph for a lake full of reeds. From there, the Proto-Sicians and Phoenicians removed crap and left it in a kind of poorly made W over time it would end up turning until it originated the Greek sigma. Another theory talks about teeth and snakes, although it's a bit silly. Although in its primitive form it has the shape of an X or a cross, this sign would end up giving rise to the T that we know through the Greek tau. There was also a letter called Z in Greece, which was an aspirated T and its sign comes from the drawing of a wheel. And we come to the end, The Z, its origin could be in the hieroglyph of a Rolo's weapon or a type of chariot. In Phoenician and Etruscan, it ended up being an I, but the Greeks gave it its famous shape with the iota. It was not used much by the Romans, and they moved it to put X as the last letter of their alphabet. And that's it for the story of the origin of letters. Ah. The goal of this channel is to summarize the entire history of humanity from beginning to end. If you want to find out what happened in the past to make the present so screwed up, I suggest you subscribe. Become a fan of the channel's Facebook page so you don't miss new episodes. And if you want to support the channel and access exclusive episodes, visit the Patreon of But That's Another Story. Oh!